Lecture 14, How We Speak, The Great Vowel Shift, and the Making of Modern English.
Hello, and welcome to The Great Vowel Shift. The Great Vowel Shift, in spite of its portentous or pretentious name, is really a very simple phenomenon in the history of English pronunciation. But it's a phenomenon which had a great impact on the sound of the English language. At the same time that the Great Vowel Shift was going on, many other changes were affecting the shape and texture of the language. And in looking at this particular set of detailed shifts in this lecture, we're going to try and see their implications and not only their larger impact on the language, but their impact on the way in which we study language. What does studying the Great Vowel Shift really mean? How can we use the resources of historical documents, of articulatory phonetics, and of our understanding of sound change in general, in order to understand and to explain, perhaps, or at the very least, to describe a fundamental shift in English pronunciation? It's probably not too much to say that the Great Vowel Shift is the single most important change that transforms Middle English into Modern English. For after it had been completed, by the middle of the 16th century or so, the Great Vowel Shift had permanently affected the way that English sounded. It was never quite pronounced the same way since. But it also distinguished the pronunciation of English from the pronunciation of every other European language. In other words, in Old English and Middle English, the vowels were pronounced very much like the vowels of other modern European languages. If you know a modern European language, if you know the alphabet of another modern European language, you will know that what makes English different, indeed, what makes it unique, not just how it's pronounced, but the names of the letters of the vowels. A, E, I, O, U. Broadly speaking, those are the names of the vowels in a modern European language. A, E, I, O, U. Those are the names of the vowels in English. If you've got that, you're halfway there. Don't be intimidated by the Great Vowel Shift. We're going to be looking at sound change in detail in this lecture, and I'm going to try to explain it as precisely as I can. But the technical material should not daunt you in your appreciation and understanding of what the difference is between A, E, I, O, U and A, E, I, O and U. What is the Great Vowel Shift? The Great Vowel Shift is a systematic change in the long, stressed monophthongs of English. What does that mean? It means that at first, a systematic change is a shift in an entire system of pronunciation. Long stressed monophthongs. Sounds that were held for a long time. Sounds that appeared in stressed positions in a word. And monophthongs. A monophthong is a sound that is pure, that's not made up of groups of sounds. A diphthong, which is a word with which you may be more familiar, is a sound made up of two separate sounds conjoined together. E is a monophthong. I is a diphthong. You can hear it, and you can feel it. When you say a vowel like E, your mouth stays in the same position throughout the pronunciation of the vowel. When you say a vowel like I, you can feel your mouth move as you move from the A sound to the E sound. A diphthong is two sounds together. When I say long vowels, too, I mean something quite specific. I'm not talking about long vowels in the casual sense that we think of E as a long vowel and I as a short vowel. These are not qualitative distinctions. They are quantitative distinctions. Let me go back a little and do a little bit of earlier philology. In Old English and in Middle English, vowels could be short or long depending on simply how long you held them. And the difference between the quantitative length of holding a vowel was a difference that was understood as a real meaningful difference. Thus, in Old English, let's say, you had two words, each of which was spelled G-O-D. Goad and goad. One of these words, goad, was the word God. Another, goad, was the word good. The only difference was the length of time that was taken to pronounce the vowel. This quantitative difference also applies in Middle English. But during the period of the great vowel shift, it starts to disappear. What I mean is that in modern spoken English, we no longer distinguish meaningfully between words where the vowels are held for a long time or not. To say sat and sat is not meaningful. Now, I have a friend who would argue that, in fact, we do have quantitative differences. And his claim would be that the difference between saying bad and bad is as meaningful for us as the difference in Old English between saying gold and gold, except in this case, bad is bad and bad is good. But that may be almost unique. In the period of the great vowel shift, long stressed monophthongs were changing. A, A, E, O, U. Let's go back to articulatory phonetics. Where are the sounds produced in the mouth? Ah is a low vowel. You can feel it low in your throat. A, it's a little higher and a little more to the front. E is very high and very close to the front. O is low and back. O is higher. U is higher still. A, A, E, O, U. Low vowels moving to higher vowels. Back vowels moving to front vowels. The best way to think about the great vowel shift, then, in beginning, is not to think about it specifically as one vowel becoming another vowel, but to think about it as a system. That is, low vowels were raised, back vowels were fronted, and two monophthongs became diphthongs. Let me try to walk through this in a technical way. Let's take the vowels E and U. Now, in Middle English, you would have said the word M-I-C-E as mice, and you would have said the word M-U-S as moose. Now, these high vowels, E and U, became, during the course of the great vowel shift, the diphthongs. E became I, and U became ow. Meese became mice, moose became mouse, lice became lice, loose became louse, and so on. The mid-vowels, which were written E and O, were raised. So in Middle English, the word, our word feet, F-E-E-T, would have really been pronounced feet. Feet became feet. The word do, written D-O, would have been pronounced more like do. And that became our modern English do. The low back vowel, ah, as in nama, became raised to a, name. And the long O pronounced aw, like in S-O, saw, in Middle English became so. Saw, so. Do, do. Moose, mouse. Nam, name. Feet, fate became feet. Mice, meese became mice. Think of these words. You can find them in modern English, and you can see how they are the result of this systematic change. Nobody knows quite why it happened, but scholars have been able to reconstruct some ways in which it happened, and we have some evidence as to when and where it happened. One way of explaining the great vowel shift is to explain it as a problem of languages and dialects in contact. Now, I've talked a great deal about regional variation. And one of the things that I've talked about that happened in the 15th century was how people from, to use Chaucer's words, Evre Shires Enda, came not to Canterbury, but to London, or to the universities at Oxford and Cambridge, to that cluster of cities, commercial and political spaces, which by the 15th century became the heart of English life. It's been argued that when dialects come in contact, different forms emerge. And when dialects come in contact, there are naturally effects from one dialect on the speakers of another. At the same time these dialects are coming into contact, as we have seen in earlier lectures, French is losing its place as a prestige language. And so it's been posited, that what's happening in the 15th century is a sort of odd case of a prestige language moving away and a new prestige form of language emerging. French gradually disappears as a prestige language. You need something to signal social prestige. What you use to signal social prestige is not another language, but a different form of the remaining vernacular. It has been argued that what happens in the Great Vowel Shift is a kind of sorting out of sounds, and that what emerges by the 16th century is a sense that certain pronunciations are now prestige pronunciations. Every culture needs a prestige form of speech. You need to register social variation through language difference. Now, you can do this by doing different languages. In the Middle Ages in England, it was French. Indeed, in the 19th century in Russia, some have argued, it was French. In classical Rome, it was Greek. Or it was even heightened forms or special forms of Latin. This idea, it seems to me, is the closest thing we may have to a truism of language use and language culture. And if it's true, then what we have in the 15th century is the replacement of a prestige language with a prestige dialect. A new dialect, a new way of pronouncing English that sorts itself out. We retrospectively, as historians of the language, may consider this a systemic set of changes. But I don't want you to get the impression that people deliberately or consciously decided to change their pronunciation. It's not as if people said, oh, we're going to raise these back vowels. Oh, we're going to front these vowels. Oh, we're going to diphthongize our high vowels now. What emerges in linguistic contact over time is how certain words change. Now, there are a couple of interesting anomalies to the Great Vowel Shift that I think are worth thinking about. One of them is historical, and another one of them is, as it were, synchronic. The historical one is this. The Great Vowel Shift didn't happen overnight. It took decades, perhaps even a century and a half, before it worked itself out. And there are many cases as late as Shakespeare, or as late even as the writer Alexander Pope, where we can see the great vowel shift's sounds not fully shifted. Now, when I taught this material as an undergraduate, to undergraduates years ago, I came across a moment in the great vowel shift when I was trying to describe how sounds became diphthongized. And I said, and I was trying to explain this, and I said, look, a sound like E becomes a diphthong first by having a schwa, just an sound. I. And then it becomes I. And a sound like oo doesn't become ow right away. It similarly goes through a transition like o. And if you listen to reconstructions of Shakespeare's English, you'll hear things like I and o. And immediately a student in the class yelled out, "Pirate English!" I said, "What?" "Pirate English, you know, I mighties." Now, pirate English is 16th and early 17th century English. It's English in which the great vowel shift is still going on, but hasn't fully completed itself. We think of pirate English as a kind of mock dialect. But as soon as the student said it, I realized, well, yes, that's right. And what's also right about it is that it is the historical or diachronic equivalent of the literary representation of dialect variation. In other words, as I was talking in an earlier lecture, when you have dialects that differ regionally, what you want to do in literature is evoke the sound of the dialect. You don't need precisely and philologically to record the nuances and details of the dialect. Similarly, when we want to evoke an earlier or distinctive period in the language, we don't need precisely and philologically to record it. Rather, all we do is evoke it. Now, 15 years after I taught that to an undergraduate, the great vowel shift remains pirate English to me still. I and O. As late as Pope, the great vowel shift seems not fully to have sorted itself out. Pope can rhyme words like L-I-N-E, line, and J-O-I-N, which we would say join. And the reason he can do it is because line, from Middle English, lean, would have probably been pronounced more like line. And join, an old French word that enters English, is probably pronounced join. Line and join. I've been told that there are people in Kentucky who still talk like that, who'll say jine for join. And what's at stake there is the preservation of an older English pronunciation as a regional dialect variant. It's not a question of illiteracy. It's not a question of inability. It's a question of a kind of fossil moment in the history of pronunciation. At the beginning of the 18th century, Pope rhymes line and join as line and jine. This kind of evidence suggests to us that something like the great vowel shift took a long, long time. Now, if we are not sure when the great vowel shift ended, we can perhaps be more sure about when and where it began. And this is also a question of written evidence. During the 15th and 16th centuries, a great number of families in England, families of wealth, but also families of moderate means, began to write letters to each other. The social practice of writing letters became one of the markers of identity and family unity in the late Middle Ages and the early Renaissance. Families with names like Selly and Stoner and Paston produced volumes of family correspondence, which still survive today. Their manuscripts have been edited, and scholars have studied them for what they tell us about daily life and personal aspiration in 15th and 16th century England. But what these letters also tell us is something about the great vowel shift. I'd like to look at a few examples of how we can use written evidence to chart the great vowel shift. And I want to call attention to a few of them. Here are some quotations from letters that I found from the 15th century. Now, these writers wrote well enough to indicate sound, but they weren't schooled in the conventions of spelling. So their spelling is, in effect, older Middle English spelling to represent newer English sounds. I'm going to read you a sentence. The Sunday about 8 o'clock, it came to Lambeth, and with me Doris Spear to meet and speak with my said lord. The Sunday, about 8 o'clock, I came to Lambeth, and with me was Doris Spear, in order to meet and speak with my said lord, the master. Now, the word meet here, in this sentence, is spelled M-Y-T-E. Now, if you were a Middle English speaker and a Middle English writer, you would be pronouncing that as meet. Yet, if you were really educated in Middle English, you would be writing it as M-E-E-T. Meet. In the age of Chaucer, that word would have been pronounced meet. To meet and speak with my lord. What this writer does is he uses some old spelling conventions to let us know, in effect, that he's saying meet. Meet has become meet. Here's another example. The word abide, A-B-I-D-E. In Middle English, that would have been pronounced abide. In the course of the great vowel shift, E became I, so we say abide. Here's a letter in which a 15th century writer says, furthermore, she is new put by her brother in Norwich with Aubrey, and she thinketh the place is rich conversant of people for her to abide in. Now, this writer has used the word abide and has spelled it A-B-E-Y-D. This person in the middle of the 15th century wants to indicate that he is not saying abide, but is saying abide. So he changes the spelling to make it sound that way. I'm going to give you two more, because I think it's fascinating to see how writers reflect sound change in its moment of change. These are letters written on the cusp of modern English. Here's another one. The cause is this, as it is told me by divers. The cause is this. The reason is this, as it is told to me by diverse people. That ye make no more suit to me, Lord, for yourself than ye do. Now here, the word suit, which we would write S-U-I-T, suit to something, is written S-W-U-T-E. A very strange spelling, but designed to indicate that the pronunciation is oo in a very strong sense. Or, let's look at another one from the Selly letters. This is a particularly good one. Master Selly, the writer writes, I pray you let your man do so much for me as to go to the scene of the stair next on to Fleming's Dam, where our daggers are made. Our. In Middle English, that would be oor. That's how you'd say it. Oor. Oor. Oo becomes ow. Moose, mouse. Oor. Our. This writer has spelled our, A-U-R. And our daggers are made, Middle English, M-A-D-E, mada. This writer has written M-A-Y-D, made. It's complicated and it's technical, but I'm trying to indicate how the great vowel shift can actually be charted in writing. There are literally hundreds of examples of these kinds of changes in writing. And I'm giving them to you so that we can see that in a moment in the middle of the 15th century, in the 1440s and in the 1450s, we can witness how sounds are changing and how writers of a certain level of class and education are responding to it. Now let me try to summarize some of this material and talk a little bit about its implications. In looking at these written texts and in thinking about changes in pronunciation, we need to understand that there is a growing gap between educated writing and speech. Chancery on the one hand, Caxton on the other. By the beginning of the 16th century, people are being taught to spell in ways that no longer reflect how they actually speak. In effect, spelling becomes what we retrospectively might call it etymological. What's also interesting is that as spelling changes, so does punctuation. If you look at texts from the late Middle Ages and the early modern period, what you see are interesting shifts in punctuation. In the Middle Ages, in English and Latin and in the vernacular languages, punctuation was what we might call ear punctuation. That is, it indicated how you were to pronounce or pause in your reading. It was designed to, as it were, shape the sound of the sentence. It was not designed to mark off grammatical clauses in the way that our modern punctuation works. By the 16th century, punctuation becomes, in effect, I punctuation. That is, it doesn't tell you how to read aloud, necessarily. It tells you how grammatically your sentence is put together. Spelling and punctuation changes go together to, as it were, estrange writing from speaking. Why do we not speak the way we spell and write? This is another example. And this notion of punctuation is a good one in enhancing our notion of the growing separation between speech and writing at this time. Now, I've said a little bit about how the great vowel shift worked, and I want to conclude with a provocation. How did the great vowel shift not work? In Middle English, there were words spelled with an E-A, and these were words spelled with an E-E. And these words, which would have been pronounced A, became pronounced E in some sense. A word like beat, B-E-A-T, which was bait, became beat, M-E-A-T. Mate became meat. There are five words which do not seem to change. That is, there are five words in modern English with an E-A spelling that seem not to have undergone the great vowel shift, where E-A signals not the sound E, but the sound A. And they are great, break, stake, yay, and the proper name, Reagan. Why didn't these change? No one knows. It's a fascinating footnote to the great vowel shift, and it seems to me remarkable that we can try to explain or chart many, many things, but just when we think we have a handle on it, just when we think our philological knowledge and our linguistic acumen has reached the point of total explanation, there's a fissure, a crack, a window onto something where we cannot get it. I'm offering these examples for several reasons. First, so you can see in modern English where the great vowel shift didn't work. Second, because it's a moment that we cannot explain. And third, it shows us that speech and writing, estranged from each other though they may be historically, occasionally contain pieces of evidence for earlier pronunciations and earlier forms. Now, in my subsequent lectures, we'll be moving beyond pronunciation to vocabulary. And in my next lecture, we will see how the English language at this time changes not only in its sound, but in its lexical resources, in the ways in which contact, not just among dialects, but among different peoples and different languages, change irrevocably the structure and the tone of English. And furthermore, we will look at some attitudes towards that change. Is the influx of vocabulary a good thing or a bad thing? Is the birth tongue, as Trevisa would have it, enhanced, or is it impaired and diluted? Thank you.